to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our new series that we're running at the Voice of Vashon. April 30th in 1975 was the end of the war in Vietnam. So in this series, we're really looking at not so much from a political standpoint what happened in Vietnam, but we're looking at more of the personal stories of people that were in Vietnam, people that served in Vietnam. And so we really think this is a, and we're also working with folks and talking to folks that are still seeing the effects of Vietnam through issues like Agent Orange. And today I'm interviewing a good friend of mine. His name is Mike Dorsey. And Mike and I grew up in Ellensburg. Oh, I think we grew up there in Ellensburg. He and I also kind of reconnected a number of years ago with a group of folks that we graduated with in 1966. And Mike did serve in Vietnam. At that time in 1966 to 1968 was really one of the buildup times. It was after the around the Tet Offensive. And let's talk about that, Mike. Should I say anything else sterling about you?
No, I think that pretty much.
Okay, then I've already given you the yes. Okay. Tell me, first of all, did you enlist? Were you drafted? How did all that happen?
Well, I actually enlisted. I thought I was just about to be drafted. I had about a year and a half of college and, had dropped out of school. And I was, pure infantry fighter.
Uh-huh.
So I thought I would cleverly enlist. And that way I wouldn't at least have to be in the infantry. So I enlisted. I'm in what they call an RA versus a U.S. U.S. is a draftee and R.A. is an enlisted person. So
Okay. And where did you do your basic training?
Fort Lewis.
Okay.
Good old Fort Lewis.
Good old Fort Lewis. And how long did that take?
About 90 days, I think, is the basic.
So they made a man out of you in 90 days or something. And taught you everything you know today.
I'm a better person.
Yes.
No doubt.
Yes. Well, and then at that point, were you deployed to Vietnam at that point?
Well, the procedure is you've got basic training, and then you go to some advanced training of some kind. They call it AIT or advanced training. And in your job, your MOS, which would be maybe, in my case, I had enlisted to be a prop and rotor mechanic on a helicopter.
Okay.
So then I was transferred back to the East Coast to Fort Eustis for training in helicopter repair and whatnot back there. And then through a series of circumstances, I wound up not finishing that course and was going to be just assigned to the training base there. But Tet had happened, and they had decided to, increase our manpower significantly.
It wasn't like almost a quarter million people or something, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I just got, the idea of me being assigned, back there was just forget that. And I was swept into the into the infantry of all places. So then I went to, Fort Benning, Georgia. I could be wrong on that.
Okay.
But anyway, another base for infantry training, light weapons infantry training, which is different, as you can. Sure. And then when that was open, when I finished that, then I deployed to Vietnam. So I got there in January of 1969.
You know, I know several of the other folks, too. I know that we graduated with. I know Alan Aronica. I think he got out of school in June, and he was in Vietnam late October. I mean, they really, you know, jumped him over there really fast. What were your thoughts when you landed in Vietnam? I mean, did it seem fast to you? Were you excited? Were you scared? Were you hot, humid?
You know, at that point, I wasn't really frightened. I think I was too naive to be frightened. I didn't really understand exactly what was happening here. Just kind of numb. You know, you're part of the deal, and off you go. And
yeah.
Go here, stand there, you know, do this, do that. So
yeah,
arrival, yeah, just kind of dazed and confused.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, it's kind of been kind of interesting for me to talk to a lot of the folks like you that were, well, like, you know, we came from Ellensburg, my gosh. You know, we had the biggest thing in the world once a year was the rodeo, you know. And that was about it. And I'm finding so many people that were just, you know, like us, average Joes in high school. And kind of wind up automatically in this giant machine over there. So when you got to Vietnam, did they immediately send you? I know you said that you worked, you did the infantry for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And where did you do that?
Well, they you know, you spend a week or a few days in country, you know, just kind of figuring out who you are and what you're supposed to do, and then they just pull you out. Assign you somewhere, and I was sent out to Tay Ninh province, which is about Tay Ninh, I don't know if it's a province, but it's northwest of Saigon, about 40 miles or so up close to the Cambodian border. They used the Iron Triangle is what they used to call it,
right?
Lucky me.
Yes.
And, so I was C-3rd of the 22nd, 25th Infantry Division was my assigned unit. We were in a place outside of Tay Ninh called Fire Base Washington. And every day we'd go out, they'd pick us up in the helicopters, and they'd take us out somewhere in the bush and insert our infantry company, and we would hunt all over the place trying to find somebody. And then if we did not, which mostly we did not, thank goodness, we would helicopter us back in. And we spent most of our time, I think I was very fortunate, because we were out of this fire base, which had an artillery unit there. And therefore, it wasn't the kind of thing where it wasn't just a straight out infantry base, which is just a very small thing, and much more prone to being attacked. This is a much bigger base, it was kind of nice. We didn't have to spend too many nights in the field. We would often get to come back in at night, and of course, we were the perimeter guards for the fire base too. So, but that was nice.
When you were a perimeter guard, did you just did you have night vision or any of that kind of stuff, or did you just kind of walk around and?
Oh no, you the fire base is surrounded by it's encircled by a big there are bunkers. You dig bunkers all around the perimeter, and they're pretty reinforced. Lots and lots of sandbags. You're down in the ground, basically. So your window, it looks out, it's a little firing port at ground level. So mostly you would spend, if you're the on-guard people, you would spend your time, you know, looking out those little windows into the dark, fire flares out now and then. See if there's if you thought there was something you wanted to take a look at.
If you thought there was motion out there or something, or yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you'd fire a flare or somebody would. We were in a pretty good spot. We had like three rows of concertina wire out in front of us, and these explosive devices, all kind of stuff. It was a pretty...
Like, did they use like a claymores?
Yeah, we had claymore mines out. So we were in a good, I think, a very easily defendable spot. It was a good place to be, I think,
mm-hmm.
in retrospect. You know, compared to some of the guys, I think I got a lucky posting because some of the guys, I have a friend who was further up north, and their infantry unit was in the field constantly. They would come back. They would spend a month out in the field, you know, sleeping in the bush, ambushes, running around, and they wouldn't come in for a month.
Yeah, some of those... You know, and I guess that's why they call them grunts, too. That's what some of these other folks, you know, that they came in, they hadn't showered in a month. And, one of my friends that we're going to interview later, a guy named Dennis Larson, he worked with dogs. And I think he probably almost went out with, groups like yours. He went out with the helicopters every morning. He said he flew 56 missions.
Mm-hmm.
And he went out every day with this dog, and the dog, he would go with a radio man and the dog, and they would go out in front and look for motion, look for, the dog would, signal on just about anything. And then depending upon what they thought they found out there, then he would, they'd radio back and they'd either call in an airstrike or, send men out. But so you at least came back to the, for most of these missions, you came back to the base at night, right?
Yeah, which I didn't, in retrospect, I'm very appreciative of that. At the time, I didn't realize the stuff that other people were having to go through, really. So you're in a very tight bubble. I'm just looking on maps, later, and I realized I didn't even know. I mean, I know where we were, but they never oriented you. You know, it's never like we got to look at a big map and say, oh, here we are. Oh, I see what we're doing. You would just go here one day and there the next day and down here somewhere the next day, and then we're going to go over here the next day. So you're just kind of, you go where they send you.
Yeah, and so you did that to... And they had actually artillery, like the big, larger artillery set up at the base there, too, that they fired?
We had a big, there'd probably be four guns, maybe six, of the 105 howitzers. So we were sweeping in the day and then protecting them at night. We also had a big mortar unit there, so there'd be lots of firing out of there to support other units, who needed artillery.
One of the pictures that you sent me too, you must have been, was that you sent me a picture. It looks like a guy holding up a grenade launcher, or what do you call them?
An RPG.
Right, RPG, right.
Yeah.
is that what that was? It's just in... It looked like he was trying to figure out how to fire it at that time. I don't know. but I'm sure you had training in that, too. This is the end that you point out,
Yeah, we don't have the right tube to shoot that thing out of, but we were, they would have B-52 strikes in the area, all the time. And, then we would very often go out the next day and sweep the area where the B-52 had dropped its bombs, and which basically means walking around these big craters full of water and mud and whatever, parts and bits and, you know, stuff. And anyway, that was one. He just happened to be standing there, reach down, and there that was laying there. So that had been, they had clearly, they'd hit something.
Uh-huh.
On that day.
So it was a Viet Cong shell? Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a friend that flew for Alaska Airlines, and mm-hmm. he flew the B-52s in Vietnam. He referred to it as a high-altitude plow, you know, because they just, when they dropped their bombs, they just dropped so many. What did your family feel like when you went into the service? Were they concerned? I know you have a sister, correct? And
a brother.
And a brother, that's right.
Yeah, younger brother, younger sister.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good question, Steve. You know, we didn't really, I have wondered that, and we've never talked about that in so many words with my parents. Actually, with my brother and sister, I haven't really asked that particular question. It's funny, you know, it's one of those things, I think those are really good questions, and I wish I'd have asked them, but we just didn't really talk about that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it just wasn't a thing. And I never thought to bring it up. So, you know, we didn't. But I am very curious. I remember when I was, before you're sent over, you got a leave. And so you come home, you know, you get a week or two or three at home before you go. And I remember going skiing with Doug Ross.
Really?
Yeah. And some other stuff. And then Mom and Dad drove me over to Seattle to SeaTac, I think, and I flew down to L.A. on a commercial flight, hooked up. And
right. Like
but,
Doug Ross, Doug Ross became an OBGYN, is what he wound up doing in Philadelphia.
Of all places.
Of all places. And now he lives in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I saw him last year, and he went there to go skiing, and the first year he went skiing, he broke his leg. So now there's bad luck, too. But, you know, that is an interesting question, because I don't think people did ask questions like that. How did you get transitioned into working on the helicopters?
Oh, well, you know, I think it probably goes without saying, this infantry, the infantry was just plain, it's hard. That's a tough thing. You know, they say, infantry is the queen of battle, I think is what they say in the Army. And I don't know exactly what that means. But I can tell you, you don't win anything militarily without the infantry. Somebody has to go in there, you know, on foot and deal with whatever needs to be dealt with.
And I even heard that it takes, that for every person that's in infantry in the field, there are 23 people behind him that are, you know, doing other jobs.
Is that what the number is?
Yeah, that's what I saw, you know, from preparing food to, supplies to clerks to chaplains to whatever.
Yeah. Oh, the logistics is horrendous to keep people in the field. Yeah, I agree with you. You really win the lotto when you get in the infantry.
Yes, that's right. I've won. Maybe not. You know, it's interesting, too, on the poster that we're using for this, the Vietnam series, it's got three pictures on it, and one is of, the infantry out there going through a field with all their packs and everything. The other picture is of a slick dropping supplies, and the third picture is of a Vietnamese person who was providing support in one of the camps, you know, laundry and all kinds of stuff like that. But So you, did they just say, well, now it's time for you to get out of infantry and you go on the helicopter now? Or is that something you requested?
You know, I requested a transfer, and I don't know exactly where the, you know, how that formed in my head. I've always wanted to, you know, I love aircraft. I've always wanted to fly. And so I think I just decided, well, why not? You know, I'll just put in for a transfer. All they can do is say no. And we got a good yuck out of it. Everybody laughed. Ha, like you'll get offline, right? Ho, ho, ho.
No, yeah.
To transfer you out of here. And lo and behold, they did transfer me over to at just about the six-month mark. I'm not sure exactly where it was, but just about 6 months approximately. They transferred me to the Crusaders, slick helicopter.
And I saw some of the pictures you showed me. There would be, when they'd be, like, probably dropping, it looks like dropping troops, there would be 10, 12, 14, numerous helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? Is that what they kind of did?
And
they could probably hold, what, 8 men or something like that?
Yeah. I want to say 6. But you can always squinch up and get a couple of more in. But I think routinely about 6 or so.
And on the helicopter, you were a gunner. Is that correct? That's on one side, correct?
Right.
Did they also have machine guns on the front of the helicopter that they can, that the pilot can operate, or are you the only hired gun?
The crew on a ship like that is the pilot, co-pilot, crew chief, and the gunner. And the crew chief sits on the other side, in the back with the machine gun, as does the gunner. And then the pilots fly the aircraft. So we're the only ones. There are helicopters that are fitted with all kinds of weaponry, but for delivering people around and the kind of stuff we were doing, there's just the two machine guns.
And so you would drop people into an area, and also I remember you telling me about, you know, kind of going in with the oil to kind of create a smoke screen. And on some of the pictures, it looked like you could kind of see that, or at least it was very smoky in some of those areas. But were you just watching for people as you landed to, what were your duties when you were doing that?
Well, the procedure was normally, when you drop people off, you don't know if anybody's there or not, right? And when you come down and land like that, you're just a giant, big, fat target.
Yeah.
So our normal procedure was you'd have usually a flight of 9 slicks with the infantry on board. And then you'd have, which would be lined up in 2 lines, a line of 5 and a line of 4 or whatever. And so you got 2 parallel lines landing. You usually try to land like that to get everybody down at one time. And then you'd have a gunship on each side. And as you start down, the gunships would fly in ahead, and then they would rocket along the perimeters of where you were going to land, on each side or one, whatever was appropriate. And then there was the smoke ship, which was a slick. Everything was stripped off of it except the machine guns, and they would have a big tank of oil and a big ring around the exhaust, and the oil pump would shoot the oil into the hot exhaust, which would billow up this huge big thing of smoke. So after the gunships, the smoke ship would drop down to treetop level and fly the perimeter of where you're going to land and make a big U of smoke. So it would fly up the right side, make a really hard turn, and fly back down the left side, and then the slicks would land. So it created a lot of smoke and confusion. And then we'd drop the infantry off and take off. And then sometimes we'd fire as we came down. We would open up and, you know.
Were you firing at things you could see, or just
usually just the wood line?
Yeah. It doesn't sound like the oil slick was would meet our green green environment things right now. Probably had a pretty big carbon footprint.
You know, there really is not a lot of ecological consideration.
Yeah.
That was later.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the smoke ship was fun to ride on, though. It was a ride, that one.
When you were you were not injured, were you, when you were in the service?
No, I was not a scratch. Very, very lucky.
Yeah, that's great. Did you, and so basically you went out and dropped troops off and then came back and picked up the same troops in the night or in the evening, in the afternoon.
Yeah, you would go out, we would drop two or three companies off in the morning. So we would take off at sunrise and go out to wherever they were and pick them up and drop them off somewhere else and then go get another company and drop them off, you know, like that. And then at some point we would find a place and lay in and shut down and hang out for a couple hours.
Mm-hmm. Highlands? Were you in the Highlands or down in the, you know, where the farms were and stuff?
Farms.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's really pretty down there. I was over there last year, and I was, like I say, interestingly, as I look back on it, I'm really surprised in my own mind of two things. One is how amazingly naive I was in terms of what a war is all about.
Yeah.
And two, how little I knew about where we were. When I was in Cambodia, and I was in Phnom Penh, and I realized I could rent a car and drive to Tain Inn, where I was stationed, in 4 hours.
Wow.
It was like and I don't know where I thought I was at the time, but I certainly didn't think you could drive to the capital of Cambodia in 4 hours.
Yeah.
I really didn't realize where.
Probably no McDonald's in Tain Inn, at least not until 10 years later or something.
Probably are now, yeah. You know what they have is 7-Elevens. Everywhere.
That's what I heard, and the other person that went back there said they have Circle K's.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That would make sense.
Yeah,
I guess.
And so that's interesting.
It's weird.
So then you got out, and any final thoughts?
Well, aside from the my general takeaway was that having a war is a very, very poor problem-solving methodology.
Uh-huh.
So it's my first thing. I should remember that. It's a really bad way to do it. And then when I got home, I thought it's funny. You get home and it's just kind of like it didn't happen. You know,
kind of a different world, I guess.
Yeah, you don't really talk about it. Nobody, you know, is that interested. And I came home. I got involved in the anti-war movement, actually, once I got back.
Uh-huh.
So I think, on balance, I didn't get right. I've heard of guys having, you know, that kind of trouble where they come home and people are very negative to them and, you know, call it names and do stuff. And maybe because I was in the anti-war movement thing, I didn't have that kind of problem.
Well, you know, it's interesting, too, though. I think at that time what we did was we looked at the news every night and we saw Walter Cronkite. And every day they had a body count.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just didn't seem real. You know, it wasn't. It was almost like these COVID things. It wasn't really real. So anyhow, we're running out of town. I'm not running out of town. I'm running out of time. But now that we've got our shots too, Mike, we can get together for lunch down there in Tacoma. So
anytime.
Yeah. It's on me. You take care and have a great day. And okay. I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
Okay.
Take care, man. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.